about Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. And on this broadcast, we'll be featuring Jeff Currier, and he'll be answering your most important questions on Golden Dorado in Bolivia. The show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're going to be broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Jeff a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure to sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name, email address on the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within about 48 hours after the show ends. If you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Jeff Currier about Golden Dorado in Bolivia. Captain Bob Jaspers of Flats Time Charters will introduce you to the Mosquito Lagoon, Indian River, and No Motor Zone of the Banana River on the east coast of Central Florida. Only a short drive from Orlando, you will sight fish for big redfish, spotted sea trout, and black drum, as well as seasonal snook and tarpon. Captain Bob is a lifetime resident of the area, and it shows in his knowledge of the local fish, flora, and fauna. Call Flats Time Charters now and arrange your next memorable adventure. You can reach Captain Bob Jaspers at 321-631-4051. That's 321-631-4051, or go to his website at www.flatstime.com. That's FLTSTIME.com. Before we introduce Jeff, I'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So you have two chances to win tonight on our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Jeff's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Jeff's book, Currier's Quick and Easy Guide to Warm Water Fly Fishing. Here's how you can win. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question is going to be about something we talk about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and location using the text box on our homepage. So listen closely and use your best typing skills, and maybe you win Jeff's book. Tonight our guest is Jeff Currier. Jeff does it all as a teacher, author, artist, guide, industry operative, and international traveler, just to name a few. With over 30 years' experience in fly fishing, Jeff has guided in waters around Yellowstone, led fly fishers to exotic destinations around the globe, and has taken over 160 kinds of fish, probably more by now, on a fly rod.
Pretty close.
Pretty close. And saltwater in over 30 countries. In the winter months, he can be found traveling throughout the U.S. demonstrating and lecturing about virtually all aspects of fly fishing. When he's not traveling, Jeff is writing or painting. His watercolors of fish are in high demand, and his articles and photography have appeared in magazines, books, catalogs, and brochures. He has appeared on television on Fishing the West, In Search of Fly Water, Real Adventures, and Fly Fish TV, and has authored Currier's Quick and Easy Guide to Saltwater Fly Fishing and Currier's Quick and Easy Guide to Warmwater Fly Fishing. As a member of Team USA, Jeff led the Americans to their first ever top 10 finish in the 2003 World Fly Fishing Championship in Spain. Notably, he was the bronze medalist in that competition, the first time a North American has ever medaled in the World Fly Fishing Competition. And the first interview we did with Jeff was on European nymphing techniques. We've also done shows on Nile perch, Mahseer in India, and many other shows. Jeff's been a common guest on our show, and we welcome him back. So good to have you back, Jeff.
Good to be back. Thanks, Roger.
Yeah, well, Jeff just told me about something I would have never have thought he would be doing, but he says he's going ice fishing tomorrow, so, and it says he loves it. So from all your tropical destinations, Jeff, that seems quite the change.
I like it all, man. You know that.
You like it all. If the line's in the water, you're good, huh?
Yep, I'm good with that.
Yeah, good, good. Well, this adventure to Bolivia sounds like it was quite exciting, so really anxious for you to share this with everybody tonight. It's a long way away from North America, that's for sure, but South America has so much to offer in the way of fishing. We probably haven't even made a dent down there. Hopefully you'll give people a real clear picture of what it's like down there, and kind of at the end, I'm sure they'll be encouraged to check it out and put it on their bucket list. So let's dive right in. We're going to talk about Golden Dorado in Bolivia tonight. So let's talk about Golden Dorado first. First of all, we don't have that in North America, and that I know of. Is it strictly a South American fish?
Yes, strictly South American fish.
And what family does it belong to, or how can you kind of describe it for us? And
yeah, you bet. They're from a family called the Caracidae, which is, that probably doesn't mean much to people, but it's a family that includes piranhas. And they don't look like a piranha. They're not short and fat like a bluegill with big teeth. They're more elongated like a trout or a salmon, only the teeth is a dead giveaway that they're much different. And the Dorado is incredibly gold in color, one of the most amazing creatures you've ever seen. When you set eyes on your first one, you never forget that color. And sometimes you'll even see them swimming around the boat, and they just stick out like a sore thumb. It's amazing that they've survived. The teeth are not real big and pointy, like, say, a barracuda, but they are very sharp, very serrated. There's a lot of them, and I've only been bit by a couple bad fish over the years, and actually was bit by a Dorado a number of years ago in Argentina, and it was memorable. I will not make that mistake again. And they use those teeth. They're fierce predators. They eat small fish, probably eat anything they want. And in Bolivia, the fish that they feed mostly on is a fish called the sabalo, which is a pretty neat-looking fish in his own. But even a 20-inch sabalo is fair game for a 20-pound Dorado.
Wow. So the color of the Dorado doesn't really have anything to do with camouflage or the waters, you know, the surroundings, the environment? Not protective coloring?
Not really. I mean, I would think maybe from this up in the sky looking down over a sandy bottom, they may be harder to see than we think. But when you're casting to them and they're sideways to you and the sun's hitting them, it's a weird scenario. I've never seen anything like it. And these guys get big, too. The ones in Bolivia commonly run between, you know, that 8 to 15-pound range. And a given week, you're probably going to see fish up to 20 pounds. In other parts of South America, they get up to 50 pounds.
Wow.
And what maybe kind of, in Bolivia.
Yeah, maybe there too. Huh? Yeah. What kind of water are they found in? Are they small streams, large rivers, lakes, or all the above?
I don't know about lakes. I don't know anybody that's fished to them in lakes, and they may be in some, but they definitely like moving water. And they thrive in the great big rivers down in the southern part of South America. And I say southern, we're still talking tropical destinations, so like Argentina, Paraguay, Bolivia, parts of Brazil. But they do migrate upstream into smaller rivers. And when you're in Bolivia fishing for them, you are way upstream in the Amazon. And the rivers they're like Western trout rivers. They're quite small and sometimes crystal clear. So, yeah, these fish go into small water as well. As long as the bait is there, they will be there.
I mean, when you talk about the size of these rivers, are you talking about like Western river size?
Yes.
Are you talking about like the Platte River in Colorado or the Bighorn in Montana? Or
yep, that's right.
In and between?
That's kind of a small one. Yeah, maybe even a little smaller in some places than, say, the Platte River or the Big Hole or Bighorn. In fact, Big Hole, I said Big Hole right there. That would be a real good example of, say, this one river there called the Itarizama that it reminded me of fishing in New Zealand. Everybody's seen pictures of New Zealand if you haven't been there. I mean, when you look at it, that's where you think you are. Yet these fish of 20 pounds are there. Incredible.
Yeah, it seems like really big fish for seemingly small waters, you know.
Boy.
We'll get into this a little bit more about what you're fishing for. So we kind of know what the Dorado is all about. And when you went to Bolivia, how did you get there? Where did you go and how did you get there?
Well, unlike most South American cities, there's not a whole bunch of direct flights from the U.S. You know, most of the cities you can get from Miami or Atlanta or from Dallas, you can be there. But we flew into La Paz, Bolivia, and then down to Santa Cruz, and the only place we could get a direct flight was from Miami, and that was on American Airlines. And La Paz, although it's probably the bigger city of the two, and it's actually closer to where we're going to go into the jungle, you don't get off there. You actually fly from there down to Santa Cruz because La Paz is over 10,000 feet. In fact, I think it's 12,000 feet high, which makes this an incredible area. You land in the Andes Mountains way up high. Most people, you know, coming from the East Coast or something, you get off the plane there and you're going to be a mess a couple hours later just because your body's not used to it. So you fly from there down to Santa Cruz, and that's where you get off the international flight. And down there is more like, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 feet high. Most people can handle that, and it's a lot warmer too. But the actual place we go to, if you drew a line between La Paz and Santa Cruz, it would be about halfway between the two cities and a little bit north of that line. And if you look at the geography there, it's incredible. You are right at the base of the Andes Mountains, yet you're in jungle. It's unbelievable. One of the most incredible places I've ever been.
So you're on the east side of the northeast side of the Andes there, and these streams are coming right out of the mountains? So it's...
They are actually coming more from the plains. There's probably, I'm sure it's getting some water from the mountains, but a lot of that water comes from a floodplain down towards Santa Cruz area and even further east from that. In fact, there's a big river down there. I can't remember the name of it, but we're fishing the tributaries of that monster river.
Yeah, I'm looking at the map now here. I see Parque Nacional is Barro Secure. Is that an area that you were in?
Yeah, it's actually, there's a national park there. I think it's called Isaboro.
Isaboro,
Secure.
Yeah.
Yep,
Cure.
That's
okay.
It. Right on the end of that. Yes, the Cure is how they pronounce that.
Cure.
And that, the Cure River is where most of the big Dorado are. That's where we do most of our fishing.
Okay. So you got off the plane in Santa Cruz, and then how'd you get to the lodge that you were at?
We actually overnighted in Santa Cruz, and then early the next morning we flew about 2 hours up into that area I just described, basically into the wetland slash jungle. And landed on a grass strip, took a small Cessna in there, and then we walked a little ways and went down to the Secure River, got on a boat, and we drove upstream for about, well, there's two lodges. The first one you go to, it's about a 15-20 minute ride to the lodge, and then you get out and check into the lodge. And that day, you don't go out with guides, but you're welcome to set up your gear, and of course, we waited around, did a little fishing right there.
Okay, so that's where you started out, okay.
And, that's called Secure Lodge.
Okay, and what were the accommodations like down there? Were they similar to what you've had in other lodges? Or nice, rustic?
Some of the nicest rooms I've ever seen. It truly one of the nicest lodges I've ever been to. You know, I do a lot of stuff in the Amazon, and usually it's more like tent camping or a very primitive lodge or living on a boat. This is... it's unbelievable. It actually blew my mind. It was like, this should be one of the seven wonders of the world, how they built this place out here. It is a really nice lodge with really nice rooms, and unbelievably, every day I was able to load my blog because we had full-scale internet, which is better internet than I have at my own house.
It's was it unbelievable. Satellite or?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You amazing. There?
Okay.
Yeah. Amazing.
So, good. Well, sounds so. Yeah, good accommodations. We had a couple of questions from Brian Adams in Bakersfield and Gary Boyer in Idaho. Both were kind of asking about, can you do Bolivia on the cheap, or can you do Bolivia, you know, on a self-guided trip? Is that possible down there, or are you pretty much locked into a lodge?
You're pretty much locked into the lodge. And, of course, that's saying a lot coming from me because 20 years ago I probably would have tried to do it. And I did get away with sometimes doing something like this in other places, but times have changed a little bit. There's more lodges than there used to be. And in this particular place, Untamed Angling, which is the company that put this whole thing together, they've made deal with the local communities down there, Indian tribes, the Somami Indians, and so that they have exclusive rights to this water. They employ these people, and these people help watch and make sure nobody else gets in there. So you really, even if you were put yourself through probably a pretty miserable 10 to 15 day boat ride upstream and got to this area, which I'm not even sure you could, you would really be out of luck when you got there.
Yeah. So it's pretty, There may be other places, I suppose, in Bolivia that you could maybe do some self-guided things, but this area not, it sounds like. Yeah. What's the cost down there for a week, and what was the airfare and transportation costs that you...
Well, this will lead to a little story. This is a place I've wanted to go to since it became, which was probably about 5 years ago. It hasn't been around very long. And when I looked at the prices when it first came out, I said to myself, I'm going to have to find a way to get there other than paying because the price is expensive. It's $7,850 this year, I believe. And you can book it directly with Untamed Angling, or you can go through, I work with Yellow Dog, and it's the same price either way. The nice thing about Yellow Dog, all those people have been there, and they can help you with the logistics, and that's not easy. Funny thing happened with me to be able to go on this trip, and by the way, I was there the last week of July, first week of August of this past year, 2013. I was always looking at the brochures when they came through the Internet, and I got to the point where I stopped looking at them because I was getting angry because I didn't think I was ever going to go. And one morning, I had nothing better to do, so I clicked it open, and there were some old friends of mine. I should say, originally, they were clients of mine at the old fly shop, and became very good friends over the years because they were such good customers, and I have fished with them around Jackson Hole. Anyway, they were in the pictures holding these great big Dorado, and I'm like, you got to be kidding me. Wow. So it was a good time for me to reach out to those guys who are from Los Angeles and shoot them an email and just say, hey, I saw you guys in the pictures, blah, blah, blah. Pretty excited for you. Looks like a great trip. And would you believe that within the next week, they sent me an email back and invited me to go next year, and they paid for everything.
Wow. That's a good deal.
Pretty good friend. Yeah. I'm glad I sent that email.
Yeah. You never know, huh? So,
never know.
But the average guy's got to pay $7,000. It's like,
yeah, I'm afraid
you don't know somebody, huh? Yeah.
I'm afraid so, but I will throw this in there. You know, a lot of the good fisheries around the world now have gone up significantly the last 3 or 4 years, and there's a lot of them that are in the $7,000 to $9,000 range, and this is a good one. That's all I'm going to say. It's if you're going to splurge and treat yourself to something that's absolutely incredible, this is the one to do it at. It is an amazing, amazing fishery.
Now, did that include airfare?
No, it did not. It included
got that on top of that, huh?
Yep, and flying from Jackson Hole, Wyoming to Bolivia, I think it was about $1,200, and that's a good price.
Yeah. Okay, good. So we know you can't do it on the cheap. And self-guided is kind of out of the question. So there you go, Brian and Gary. You got your answers. But sounds like an experience of a lifetime. So let's dig into that experience a bit and learn more about it. But first, let me take a quick break, and then we'll come back and we'll talk about the fishing you did down there. Women's Fly Fishing in Alaska is owned and operated by well-known female guide Pudge Kleinkopf. Women's Fly Fishing offers several lodge-based fly fishing schools for women, as well as an array of small group-guided trips for women and couples to some of Alaska's best-known waters for salmon, rainbow trout, arctic grayling, and char. Pudge also leads saltwater fly fishing groups to Mexico each spring. Beginners are welcome, and equipment is provided. Learn more about fly fishing for women at www.womensflyfishing.net. That's womensflyfishing.net. Or call Pudge at 905-274-7113. That's 907-274-7113. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Jeff Currier about Golden Dorado in Bolivia. If you'd like to ask Jeff a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. So, Jeff, what have you been doing in the fly fishing world lately? I know you've been doing a lot of shows, right?
I've been doing a lot of shows. I've got three shows under my belt and 9 speaking engagements already under my belt for this year. It's been a busy one.
Oh, wow. Anything else on the horizon besides ice fishing that got you excited?
Yes, I have a monster exploratory trip that I'll leave on. I think I'm leaving March 20th. But I'm going to fly into Dubai, and I'm going to spend a couple days there. I've got a guy that actually might take me out fishing a couple days, and then from Dubai I'm going to Sudan to meet some of my South African friends from Tourette Fishing. They're the guys that I've actually done a show with you about tiger fishing.
Right.
Anyway, they have an exploratory trip going on, and we're going to fish the Red Sea for about 10 days.
Wow, a lot of salt water.
Yeah,
there,
it's going to be incredible. Should be incredible.
Yeah.
Not much information from there, which is always a good sign.
Yeah. Not well traveled, huh? Yeah. Well, that should be exciting. Good. Well, good for you. All right. Well, let's jump back in and talk about Dorado and fishing down there. So you arrived at the lodge down there, and what was the plan for the week for fishing?
Well, we're going to fish as hard as we could. Unfortunately, we got some kind of bad news right when we got there. I noticed that it was exceptionally cold at night. In fact, that night in La Paz, it's kind of a tropical city, and it was down to 39 degrees that night. And I noticed everybody was freaking out about it. It was the coldest that anybody could ever remember there. And sure enough, when we got into camp, they were experiencing colder than normal weather, and that does quiet down your jungle fish big time. They weren't used to that weather. So we were informed that fishing was going to be difficult. It had been difficult. The water was also a little lower than normal, which is unusual for me. You know, my nickname, Monsoon Courier, I'm used to floods, not drought. So we had our hands full right off the bat. So we got rigged up the best we could and got ready to give it our best.
And I got a question here on the Internet from John in Newark, Delaware. He says, seems like this is a pretty wet place. Is the fishing subject to getting washed out? Obviously, you weren't in that during that time, but is that something that happens a lot in that area?
You know, I think it's an unusual circumstance where when they get big rains, unless it's absolutely horrific, I think when they get the big rains, it triggers the fish to move, and they do find flies in murky water, because one of the rivers we fished in this trip is always a little bit off color, and I found that other times I fished Dorado as well. So, you know, when you think about it, salmon and steelhead, often the same thing. When a river gets a push of water, the fish move up. So that can be a good thing.
Mm-hmm. I did get another question here, just kind of backtracking a bit. Bruno in Pittsburgh asked, is Bolivia safe to travel to, and are there any precautions that you had to take before traveling there or while traveling there?
Well, the only precautions that you really have to do is, you know, your meds. You got to make sure you're protected from, you know, insects and whatever sicknesses are down there. I believe yellow fever, it's something I've always had anyway, a shot for that. I believe that's required, and I don't recommend going to the jungles of South America without it anyway, so you should get it, period. And then the people, you know, there's definitely some issues between our government and their government, but, you know, me, I go to places like that all the time, and what I find is you just be your friendly old self, and, you know, they're human beings, you're a human being. The governments may not like each other, but I thought the people were wonderfully friendly. I actually really enjoyed walking around Santa Cruz and meeting the people and just having a good time.
Yeah, good. Okay, good. So the water was chilly, and now you ended up going to two lodges, right, during the week you were there?
Yeah, the way it works, they have a few different programs, but the program we did was we went to their two main lodges, which are about a 20-minute flight apart. That's how we got between the two. But the first 3 days, you're at the Sicure Lodge, and then the second 3 days, you're at the Pluma Lodge.
And do you, you know, at the lodge, are you fishing the same waters every day? Are you moving up and down the river? How does it work? And is it anything like we've experienced up here, you know, in the States?
It's actually very well organized in that you don't have to fish the same water twice. They don't want you to. They want you to enjoy new water every day. So they break, each place has three beats. In fact, I think the Pluma Lodge has four beats. But on the three beats at Sicure Lodge, they're labeled 1, 2, and 3. And six people are allowed at these camps, at these lodges. So two guys go to 1, 2 guys go to 2, 2 guys go to 3, and then the next day you all rotate. So you're fishing water that was fished the day before, but you have not fished it. Your guide, on the other hand, which is another key thing, he is actually locked into that beat almost permanently, at least for the week. So he really knows where the fish are. You know, if the guys the day before saw a big fish but didn't get him, he's going to put you right on him, and you're going to have a shot at that fish. And the other thing I should mention, too, which is I actually read about the way it worked, and it didn't sound good to me, but after doing it, it was great. And what I'm talking about is they have the locals that move the boats around. A lot of times it's dugout canoes. Depending where you're at, when we were there, the water was so low, we were walking most of the time. Anyway, you have your local guy guide that moves the boat around, but you also have a true fishing guide that speaks English and helps you and tells the guide where to move the boat around. And at first I was thinking, well, that's just too many guys to have around. I don't really love to be guided anyway, but it was fantastic, mainly because the guides there were fantastic. Most of them Argentines that spoke very good English and are very passionate and knowledgeable about fishing in general, not just Dorado. Great guys.
Okay. So tell us about your first day fishing.
Well, I should tell you what I was using. I guess I, you know, for Dorado fishing, probably the best all-round rod is a 9-weight. Most people probably bring an 8 because throwing a 9, you know, for a week solid is tough, or even more so a 10. But a 10 would not be, you know, overgunned for these fish because when you hook a big one, it's amazing. I was using a 9. In fact, I was using like the Winston saltwater rods, the Boron 3SX. It's a great rod for this type of thing, great rod for throwing the big flies. Normally you would be using an intermediate sinking line, like maybe a tarpon taper from Scientific Anglers, but the water was so low we had the good fortune of being able to fish floating lines most of the time. Most importantly though, on your lines, you just have to have a tropical type line. Do not go down there trying to take a shortcut with a cold weather line, because despite the cool evenings that we had, once the sun comes up, and it came up every day, it got into the 80s. And towards the end of our trip, when it became normal temperatures again, it was well up into the 90s like the Amazon typically is. So we had floating lines, 9-weight rods, and we went out and just covered as much water as we could. We basically, if our beat, I think the first day we had beat 2, and I was with Skip, and B2 is probably, let's say, 4 miles long. We fished every inch of that 4 miles during our day, which is, you know, it's a good 8 or 9 hour day. Fish, they live in structure. You know, a lot of us have trout fished, you know, with a streamer, casting to the banks or getting out and casting the structure in the middle of the river and tailouts. Dorado, the same exact way.
Hmm. And so, but, and you were throwing basically, what kind of flies were you throwing? Streamers?
We were throwing, yep. Big streamer type stuff. There are some specifics. They have a really fun fly called the Titanic, which is almost like a popper type thing that wobbles across the top of the water. Unfortunately, it was not a good week for it. I guess, you know, with the low water and cool temps, they weren't looking up at all. So we fished whistlers, we fished clousers, some Pagliuzzi type streamers. I use a lot of the Warpath jig flies, and color wise, dark colors, blacks and orange, blacks and purples, blacks and red. Stuff that, you know, has weighted eyes on them, so they drop and jig a little bit when you're swimming them back.
And was that all stuff you brought with you, or did they have the flies down there? Sounds like all the stuff you're familiar with. So,
yeah, it's in my box. But they probably, you know, I honestly don't know if they have flies down there. I think they do because they have guides, which are, you know, I'm sure like any guides are eager to tie flies for your clients and make a few extra bucks.
Yeah.
But I brought most of mine. And you know what? The nice thing is there are a lot of shops in the U.S. now that style people out for going Dorado fly fishing.
Oh, okay. Okay, good. So the water you were fishing on this first beat, was it, what was the size of the water there? I mean,
it was a pretty good size. This, you know, at this place you're fishing the big river, the Securé, so it's about twice the size of a, you know, say the Bighorn up in Montana, and quite a bit deeper.
Yeah.
This particular stretch was more like a quarter mile of slow pool type water, and then there would be a couple hundred yards of fast water, and usually the Dorado would be from the tail out of the slow pool down to about 100 yards into the bottom of the rapid. But I'll tell you what, Roger, that first day, you know, it was tough. The guys that took me, this was their third or fourth trip there, and they've always had incredible fishing. We had awful fishing that first day. I got completely blanked on the first day, and Skip, who's been there 4 times, got one small Dorado. It was tough.
Not a good day. Okay, let's move to the second day.
Yeah, right.
That's why we go for a week at a time, right? Because you never know what day's going to be good or how the weather's going to be. So.
Absolutely.
All right, day two. Tell us
day
about
two
that.
Day two was similar type water. We had beat 3, so basically we started where beat 2 ended, which would be going downstream and then going the next 4 miles. And number one, I think I had a little better idea what we were getting into. I definitely saw some fish that I didn't catch the first day because of the shallow, clear water and the cold temps. I think they were a little extra spooky. So I got out of the boat more. Skip got out of the boat more. And, you know, we kind of crept up on those spots that normally you would just bam, throw your fly into and made a little more stealthier cast. And right away in the first morning, I, you know, got a fish that was about 9 pounds. And then we got a number of fish under 10 that day. Still no great big ones until about the afternoon. Skip got, I can't remember, but it was a nice fish, maybe 16 pounds. I was excited. I thought that was a great fish, and it seemed like a great day. Of course, I was comparing it to day one. Skip was still like, this is horrible for fishing down here. There's really something going on with this weather.
Oh, no. Go all that way, and things just aren't working out. Yeah, well, still a 16-pound, 18-pound fish is a pretty nice fish. I don't care what kind of fish it is. Yeah, yeah. So, Gary Boyer just wrote in on the internet, and he wanted to know, were you catching any incidental fish along with the Dorado? Is there any? Yes, are there any pariah there?
I did not see any. He's probably saying payara, and I did not see any payara.
Spanish is terrible.
Smaller species of payara there, but we didn't see any. But we did get into some other fish. There's a fish called the Yatarana, which is another. It's a fruit-eating fish. He's kind of got the shape and everything of a Dorado, but he doesn't have the teeth like a Dorado. He's got more molars. What he'll do is he'll come up very gently and take a leaf or a flower petal or a nut or a fruit that falls in the water, and he'll come up and he'll eat that. So you do catch him occasionally on the Dorado streamers, but I recommend also bringing along like a six-weight rod and some big Chernobyl-type stuff. In fact, if you've got goofy-looking Chernobyl ants in your box that used to actually work, like size 4s and 6s. I know I'm basing my reference here from Jackson Hole. We used to catch cutties on these great big stupid flies, and somehow they've got smart. Evolution takes place fast in Teton Park. But those flies work really good for Yatarana's down there in Bolivia as well as other parts of South America. So it's a great fish to fish for. The other one is the Pacu, which is a fish I really wanted to catch in this trip. And I had hard luck with them. They, like the Dorado, were not as active as they normally are. Some of the guys in the group did get them, but I think because I actually focused on them a couple days, yeah, I jinxed myself. I hooked a couple but never landed one, so I guess I got to go back.
Still on the bucket list, huh? Yeah.
Yeah, it is. I need more of those. And there's different kinds of Pacu, too, but this is the big boy. I need this fish.
You need it. Okay. Just got... Marcelo Perez just wrote in. He's in Buenos Aires listening to the show in Argentina, and he wanted to make mention that the picture I've got of Jeff on the homepage is not a Dorado but a tigerfish, and I'm well aware of that. So we'll have to, when we get this show published, we'll get a couple of Jeff's pictures up there for the Dorado. Yeah, quite a
And they can
fish.
Go to my blog too, Roger.
Yeah,
I've got
yeah.
a lot
and,
of pictures
but,
there.
Tell them, it's jeffcurrier.com, right?
Yep, jeffcurrier.com, and you click on blog, and on the right-hand side, you know, is the scroll area there, and just click on 2013, August, and you'll see, actually click on July, and you'll see where the trip to Bolivia starts, and you can just tab through the whole thing for 10 days.
Yeah.
Great photos.
Great photos there. So you can keep track of Jeff's travels there in the future as well, so. He does really good chronicling of his travels and adventures, so it's fun, a fun read. Eric from Clemson wrote in, how deep was the typical water you guys fished in?
Well, it definitely varied. I got to say, at the first place here at Securay Lodge, the fish were fairly deep. I'm sure at times they go in shallow because later on in the trip when we went to Pluma, we caught the fish shallow, but the water had warmed up by the time we got there, so... They were probably down deep where the water temperatures were a little more stable, and that's where we had to fish for them that first 3 days. But when things are happening, they're in where the bait fish are, and the bait fish are very shallow. There was a time where I actually saw Dorados going through, and we're talking big Dorados, 10 to 20-pound fish, where their backs and eyeballs were out of the water as they were swimming across 4 inches chasing bait. It was really a spectacular sight.
Now, are those Sabalo, are those the fish we see in videos sometimes where they're flying out of the water? Or is that some other fish? You know what
Sabalo,
I'm talking about?
I'm not sure which ones you're talking about exactly, but Sabalo do fly out of the water like crazy. Sometimes they jump out of the water when the boat's going, and then when a school of Dorado is chasing them in, you know, less than a couple feet of water, they fly out of the water like crazy. quite a sight.
Seen some videos of boats going up rivers down there and fish flying out into the boat and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, that's probably them.
Yeah, okay. And so the third day down there, you had 3 days there at that lodge, right?
That's right. The third day we went to Beat One, so that put us way upstream and some of the most amazing water I've ever seen in my life. Again, very similar to what you would expect in New Zealand, only you're fishing in the jungle. We saw quite a bit of wildlife. I'm going to tell you right now, the bird life, unbelievable. Saw some deer, saw some of the famous Amazon otters, which are these gigantic, beautiful animals. Always see them when I'm in the Amazon. In addition to the mammals and bird life, the most incredible thing you're going to see is butterflies. And I see butterflies all over the world, but I've never seen anything like what I saw in Bolivia. Some of the most amazing butterflies, plenty of them everywhere you looked. In fact, if you set like your backpack on the ground and then turned away from it and you came back, there's sometimes there would be 25 the most beautiful butterflies you ever saw attracted to, and in my case, they're the green in my backpack. So that was very memorable and very cool, and there were a lot of them on that upper beat. Fishing-wise, it was, you know, our days just kept getting better as it got warmer. And that day, I think Skip and I probably caught 25 or so fish. Again, not huge ones by Skip standards, but I was delighted. I mean, we got a lot of fish that day between the 8 to 12-pound mark. And small, skinny water, too. It was really amazing.
Now, with that skinny water, were you doing sight fishing or were you blind casting?
You know, mostly blind casting there because you were actually throwing in against these cliffs, which were in the shade. But there were times, once our guides got confidence in our abilities to, you know, stand up on a dugout canoe and stuff, I would stand up in the front. And sometimes you see the Dorado skipping along just below the surface. Or, like you say, you see the Sabalo spray, you know, leaving the water. And I would fire a fly in there immediately and nail a fish.
So would they move a good distance for the fly?
If they heard it flat, they would charge 10 feet, no problem. As long as they heard it.
More like a pike in nature, would you say?
Much faster, though. Much faster.
Much faster.
And believe it or not, they hit even more ferocious than a pike. Just unbelievable.
Huh. Good, good. Well, let's take a quick break here, and then we'll come back, and we'll move to Lodge 2 and see how fishing was there, okay?
Yep.
Keening's Fly Shop in Sacramento, California features classes on all aspects of fly fishing. They have an extensive inventory and fly tying department and friendly, experienced staff whose primary goal is your complete satisfaction. Among their many services, one can book private waters or take advantage of their international travel service. Visit their extensive website at www.keeney.com. That's K-I-E-N-E.com. Or call Keening's Fly Shop at 1-800-400-0359. That's 1-800-400-0359. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Jeff Currier about Golden Dorado in Bolivia. If you'd like to ask Jeff a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer it on the show tonight. Okay, so you had to fly. You said you had a 20-minute flight to the next lodge, right?
That's right.
And then you spent 3 days there fishing? Is that what the program was?
Yep.
Okay.
And it was a little more travel than that. First of all, we had to get back to the landing strip, so it was back on the boat, short hike, got on the plane for 20 minutes. Then, this time, we actually rode, so we're further downstream the Securé River, 20-minute flight further downstream, but now we're going to go up a tributary of the Securé called the Pluma River. So we hopped on a boat after the plane dropped us off, and we actually rode in the boat for almost an hour, and then got out of the boat, and somehow they have a couple very souped-up four-wheel drive vehicles. I guess I don't know how they got them in there. But we had to have those vehicles because now we have an hour drive through 18 inches deep mud, rutted, cut-out road right out of the jungle to get to this next lodge, the Pluma Lodge. The trip itself was as exciting as a day of fishing. I love that kind of stuff. Some people maybe me. But I just thought it was a hoot. I mean, doggone, it was impressive what we got through that day.
So you did you do any fishing that day, or just was it all travel pretty much?
That day I did photography, but a couple of the guys went out. A couple of the other guys' names were Tom and Dale, and Tom and Dale went upstream, and I went with them with my camera. It was you know, I've got to get good pictures on these trips, and we were having a little shortage of big fish. I was hoping they'd lay a big fish down for me, and also I wanted to get some pictures of those butterflies. So I followed along, and they didn't catch a big fish, but they cleaned up on the 5 to 8 pounders. It was really a fun afternoon.
Yeah, good. We had some more questions come in here. Michael wanted to know, and Clemson wanted to know, if there are any predators you had to worry about down there while you're fishing.
Well, there's quite a few jaguars around, and that's a serious cat. It's not like my tiger story years ago that I gave you, but it could be that way. I mean, it's a cat, and it's a big cat. It's the biggest one in this hemisphere. They're dangerous. I don't recall seeing any crocodiles, but I know the Amazon is full of them, so there could be crocodiles there. My experience with crocodiles in South America, though, they see you, they're out of there. They're not going to hurt you unless you're really, really unlucky. There's snakes, absolutely. There's poisonous snakes down in South America. If you're walking through the jungle, you know, you got to watch where you're stepping, or at least avoid real, real thick vegetation in places where there might be a snake. Just common sense. And most of us here in the States deal with rattlesnakes. So, you know, we keep our head about us when we're on our home waters. The same down there. I don't worry about too much things. There are some insects that could probably do you some harm. Long sleeve shirts, long sleeve pants, and insect repellent, and I'm pretty safe anywhere in the world.
Yeah. So it's not like it might be in Alaska where your guide brings a sawed-off shotgun with slugs in it from the boat to watch you as you fish. Wasn't
right.
That case? Oh. Yeah. Do you see any tracks of jaguars? Or?
Oh yeah, we saw a lot of tracks. But like most cats, you know, you and I live in the Rockies. There's a lot of mountain lions around, but we're lucky when we see one.
Yeah.
It's the same with the jaguars. But all the guides down there have had a couple of jaguar experiences. There are a lot of them there.
Yeah. You spend that much time in the jungle, you're gonna probably come across one now and again. Yeah. Okay, so you spent the night there in the lodge. You went on your first beat down there the next day then, and how was that?
It was a bust. I was fishing with my friend Tom now, who instigated bringing me on this whole trip. Thank you, Tom. It was a pretty awesome deal. So the next 3 days I was going to fish with him. And there's no doubt we knew in advance that we were going to the most difficult of all the rivers there. It's called the Itarizama, or I'm not sure exactly how you pronounce it. But I still was glad to go here because it's probably the most photogenic of all the rivers. It's the one, when you look at their brochure, when you look at my pictures, look at their website, you say, wow, that looks just like New Zealand, until you see the big gold fish come out. So it was important to me to actually get to fish this river. I think it's just one of the great rivers on the planet. Unfortunately, in that low water, in the cold water, the Dorado that we saw that day, sometimes we would literally just raise our rod in the air, even though we thought we were stealthy, and these fish would run. For dear life, they would see us. And believe it or not, I think that first day in this location, I believe me and Tom each only caught about 3 fish apiece and no big ones. I had one great big 20-pound plus fish on a piece of water that was about 20 feet wide, fast rapid, and I just had no chance at landing this fish. It was pretty incredible.
So the big fish, do they run? Do they bottom out? How do they act? Or is there another fish you could compare it to in the way that they fight?
They would be a lot like cooking a fresh steelhead. I mean, they take your fly very violently, very fast. They're lightning fast. You'll see a fish turn for your fly, and you never, next thing you know, he's on. And I didn't mention in the beginning there, because of the teeth, you obviously have to use wire. And as far as a leader goes, you can go down there and be real sporty and bring down some, you know, 9-foot, 20-pound leaders, something that people may typically use for salmon or something. But you're not going to land many fish with that rig because of the rocks and how fast these fish will smoke you downstream and get into some wood or something. So what we use is straight 40-pound test, about 6 feet, and then straight 40-pound wire, about a foot of it. When you hook a Dorado, they take off like a bolt of lightning, and then they'll start jumping like a salmon or a steelhead. They're in the air. I'd say if you hook a 15-pound fish, you're going to fight him for probably 4 to 6 minutes, and he's going to jump anywhere from 8 to 15 times. It's absolutely incredible.
Sounds exciting. Yeah. Sounds sounds real exciting. Good. So you said every day got better, right? Well, we kind of went. Is the next day
we
better?
Went down,
I mean, this story is not getting that exciting, Jeff. You know, I mean, I hate to say it, but it's just not very exciting so far here.
Well, we went downhill. We went downhill, but the other guys on the other places did a little better. In fact, two of the guys didn't get along very well. I say should say around very well. They got along fine. They didn't get around very well. Older guys, and they could not wade and walk, so they went to the Securé. And these guys, they probably got a dozen fish over 10 pounds, including one 26-pounder. So down in that lower Securé, I got the opportunity to fish that. It probably would have been an unbelievable, memorable experience. The other guys, they were on the lower Pluma, and they did okay. They got maybe four or five nice fish, but they also got a fish over 20 pounds. So things are getting better for everybody, and the next day we were going down to that lower Pluma. I wanted to go to the Securé and get in the boat, but those older guys, they had to do that pretty much every day because that's the one thing. If you can't get around very well, you really limit yourself. You know, these guys were all friends, so those old guys, that's the only place they got to get, that they could handle. They got to fish it every day. But if you didn't know the people, you'd probably get rotated and it would be tough.
There's a lot of hiking around, both in water and down trails and so forth.
Yes, and the more you put into it, the more water you cover and the better you're going to do. So I think I really beat up my friend Tom. He's in his late 60s, and I always forget, you know, I'm only 48, so I move pretty quick still.
Yeah.
He hung in there, though. He hung in there.
Yeah. Well, there's those of us that keep trying, you know. I mean, it's like my annual backpack with my kids is tougher every year, but I get it done. Let's say, get it done. So what was the next day like?
So that I guess would be the fifth day of the trip now. Well, we got into some pretty nice fish. I think I probably caught six or seven fish that day in that 8 to 12 pound range. Still, the giant fish were not showing themselves for me, but I did have a really fun experience that day. I was throwing some real long bombs across the river. The river's a little larger down where we were in the lower Pluma. Still not more than 110 feet across, but anyway, I waded out and I was just getting my fly to the other bank, and I hooked about maybe a 15-inch Dorado. And that's not what you're there for, so I didn't fight him at all. Remember, 40-pound test, I'm using a 9-weight rod. I just started stripping him in as fast as I could to get him in, get him off, and get my fly back out there. And as I brought him across the pool, a absolute monstrosity of a fish. You know, I'm not real good at estimating fish when they're over 25 pounds because, unfortunately, I don't get to handle that many. But this fish was over 25 pounds, and he grabbed my 15-incher, and remarkably, he hooked himself. And I got five jumps out of this giant fish while my smaller 15-incher was spinning around his jaw on the hook as well. And unfortunately, after those five jumps, I lost the big guy and got the small guy in, and he was dead as a doornail. But it was exciting. It was
really cool. You always hear about those stories, or with pike like that. Or usually it's the story is the fish you get on has a fish sticking out of his mouth already. You know, I suppose that happens with Dorado too, as voracious as they are. But, yeah, that had to be exciting. That poor little Dorado, though, he got the ride of his life,
thing. I did a horrible thing, too. I launched him back out there on my fly. It was not easy to cast him back out there, but I threw him right back in the middle of the pool, hoping that big fish would hit it again because it was so darn entertaining. But there just wasn't enough life in that fish left, so the big boy was gone. Plus, I think I had hooked the big boy pretty good, so he wised up fast.
Yeah.
But it showed me what was in the river, you know. I knew they were there. I heard they were there. But, you know, every day getting a little bit closer, a little bit closer.
Well, it's not easy to get a trophy fish wherever you are, right? I mean, that's why they're
that's
trophies.
Right.
Yeah. Eric in Boise wrote in here on the Internet. He said, do you have to make long casts, 60, 80-foot casts, what's the distance, normal cast?
You don't. If you can make a 40-foot cast, you're fine because, you know, you could wade into place or the guides could move the dugout into place where you could make your cast. Absolutely, there is an advantage to casting further because you can cover more water without moving your feet as much. But, no, 40-foot, good solid cast at 40 feet, you're going to do just fine. I don't recall there being hardly any wind or anything there either, so casting was quite easy other than the fact you're throwing big flies.
Yeah, wearing you out that way. Yeah. Lanford in Castle Rock wrote in and said, your voice is coming through clearer than any speaker he's heard on the show. and don't know what we did differently. Well, Jeff's got a cold, so maybe that's it. Lanford, I don't know. We use the same technology every time, and we do have all different phone connections. And you're on a cell phone this time, right?
Oh, yeah, I got my cheese ball flip open. That's where I'm at in the history books.
So you don't have a expensive phone or a great connection, and you got a cold and you're coming through loud and clear. Well, that's good. So good to know, Lambert. Thanks for filling us in there. Oh, yeah, and Eric also asked about large fly. We really didn't talk about the size of the flies you were using. He says, are they like 10-inch or what size were you using?
6 to 7 inches for Bolivia is a pretty standard fly. But I'm going to just give a tip for all worldwide fishing and jungle fishing and Dorado fishing. Always bring smaller flies. Big fish eat big flies, but big fish also eat smaller flies, whereas sometimes smaller fish won't eat the big flies, so it's good to have normal-sized flies. I did catch a handful of fish, no doubt about it, on normal 3 to 5 inch flies. And just for the record book, I have found that Dorado fishing in other places like the Rio Paraná down in Argentina and the Ibra Marsh, these giant flies that were thrown here in Bolivia were probably not the best ones for down there. I used smaller flies.
Okay.
But Bolivia, yeah, big black and orange, black and purple. If you could throw them, these fish, they're vicious. They eat them.
Did you, at this point during the trip, had you learned anything about Dorado fishing that you were doing differently? Phil did ask here California, Kentucky. He says he loves it that you had some tough fishing because most of his fishing is always tough, he says. But he says, what steps did you take to avoid the spooking the fish if your rod was frightening them? And so I'll just add on to that. And, what other things did you learn at this point during the trip?
Well, real quick to answer his question, a lot of times when I have spooky fish, spooky big fish where I still have to use a big rod stuff to get my fly and heavy line out there, heavy fly. Sometimes a sidearm cast is very, very good technique. You can cast over your head, and a lot of times the loop rolls and your fly splats in the water. If you go sideways, number one, your fly line stays a little lower profile. It's not flying high through the air, and fish may not see it at all. And also, when your loop unfolds with a sidearm cast, it doesn't splat in the water. It goes out, straightens out, and then it settles on the water. Basically, as hard as how high off the water you are. So if I'm really being gentle, I'll have my rod tip, 6 inches off the ground, 6 inches off the water. So my loop is just going right above the top of the water. Comes down real gently. Good technique.
Yeah.
Okay, moving on to learning about the fish. Yes, one of the things I noticed at the lodge, which I really liked, is that all the guides were good and they all had some of their own game plans. It was made just like around here, every guide goes to different places on the river and they might choose a different fly even though you fished the same water the day before another guy and did well. So you do well with both techniques, but I definitely picked up on the different things they did. And one of the things that I learned, and I had not done this on previous Dorado trips, was that these fish sometimes are in remarkably shallow water and fast water. Someone asked earlier about do they feed shallow. Yeah, here was a circumstance where they absolutely did. And some of the fastest water, and it was water. Here we are on the fifth day of the trip. I had been avoiding this water much of the trip, and this guy was having us hit it, and sure enough, we were catching some fish. Could have been because it was warmer later in the week. I don't know, but I learned something.
So you could... Are you saying you can really find them almost anywhere in the river?
You better be prepared to hit every spot you can. Unless there's a real great spot, your guide said, let's hurry on down because we're running out of time, you might as well hit it all because they could be there. They really
could.
Could
be anywhere. Yeah.
I always have a saying, if the water looks really good, you fish slow. If the water looks, you're not quite sure, but it needs a try, just fish it. Just fish it fast. The fish will show you if he's there.
Zach wrote in, he says, if you could redo your trip, what would you do differently? Fly selection, time of year, certain patterns, but is there anything you would change?
Well, I mean, it was weather-related more than anything, so, you know, I didn't come home thinking I did a lot of stuff wrong. I guess had I known the water was that low, or and even if I knew, I still would have gone there thinking, you know, I need a big rod, but maybe I could have got by with an 8-weight rod most of the time, maybe even a 7-weight rod. I know some of the guys that have been to Bolivia many times are thinking, my God, Curry, you didn't see enough big fish. You can't do it on a 7, but realistically you can. I mean, you can point a 7-weight rod at a big fish and not put too much bend in the rod and treat it like it's a 9-weight and still land a big fish. But my line would have been lighter hitting the water. 7-weight's easier to cast, and I just might have been a little more effective in the stealth factor.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you think the biggest thing was the weather, and as it warmed up during the week, things got better and better and better, right?
Yes, it did.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, it did. And you were finding fish in more in different kinds of water as well, it sounds like. So what do we have? We have one more day left?
Yeah, our last day, we had to go to the Upper Pluma, which we knew in advance it was going to be a lot like the that day four when we went up the small New Zealand Lake River, the Itarizama. But it was assigned to us, you know. I was a guest, and, you know, it still is good water. It's just that, you know, I would love to have gone in that lower Securé, but it wasn't possible. So we went up the Upper Pluma. And to increase our chances of having really good fishing, we actually hiked for 4 hours. My man Tom hung in there like a champ. But we hiked for 4 hours before we even made our first cast.
And, wow.
You're thinking, okay, well, that's 8 hours of hiking for the day. Luckily, it's not really that way, because as you're hiking upstream, they have some of the staff there coming upstream behind you all day long with a dugout canoe. So we were able to only walk an hour out and then hop in the dugout canoe and get pushed down river at the end of the day. It was pretty nice. A couple cold beers and just relaxed and enjoyed the scenery. But long story short, we got way up there. We actually got above one of the camps that Tsunami Lodges have. They have these out camps, which, you know, you can stay in, and then you're already way upstream on some of these rivers to areas that very, very rarely get hit. And from that camp up, I got to tell you, it was our best fishing of the trip to this point. Every pool had a big fish in it. When I say big, we didn't get a 20-pounder, but we got a couple 12s, a couple 14s. I got a 16-pounder. Tom got a couple fish up to 16 pounds. So, you know, we were at ease. The trip was a success. The only thing that was really irritating me at this point is I still had not got a darn pacu, and I was trying for him couple of days, especially when the dorado fishing was a little slow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so you ended up, like you said, you got skunked on the pacu, so but you did get some nice fish. But still looking for that trophy, huh? At the end of the trip, right?
Yeah. When you go to Bolivia, you should come home with a 20-pounder under your belt. And
yeah.
You know what? I've got a lot of experience chasing weird fish around the world. I know that what's supposed to happen doesn't always happen. In fact, it often doesn't happen. And so I was not, like, brokenhearted on it. Sure,
yeah.
I would love to have caught that big fish, but it wasn't going to ruin my trip. I was very, very excited that I had fished Bolivia, spent time with long-lost friends, really. And,
yeah.
What a deal. What a deal.
Now, you said you had fished for Dorado before. And where, Argentina, did you say?
Yeah, I went to a place called the Iber Marsh many years ago, which is, I think we took a 10-hour bus ride north of our Buenos Aires and fished. It was a great place. Kind of reminded me of the Everglades, only it's fresh water and the fish are different. And then I did an exploratory trip on the Rio Paraná by the border of Paraguay, that part of Argentina up there. And that was kind of a bust. Turned into a more of a catfish fishing trip, which quite honestly was a blast as well. I'm glad I got to do it.
We got some more questions coming in. Bruno asks, is it all streamer fishing? Any poppers used or nymph patterns?
Normally the poppers will work pretty good. It's really hard to hook a dorado on a popper. I threw a popper out there a little bit, and, you know, we didn't have very good action probably, again, because of the water temperature. But the dorado that took my popper, I think I hooked like one of six or seven of them. But when I was mentioning flies, I mentioned that pattern called the Titanic. And although not a gurgling type popper, it does skim across the top of the water, never goes under. And when conditions are right, that is one of the favorite patterns for fishing in Bolivia for Dorado. And I would love to go back and hit it when that's rocking, because it's just got to be a sight.
Oh, yeah. Got to be a real kick. Yeah, yeah. Gary Powell from Little Rock wrote in. He says, are you going to take Granny next time?
Man, Granny's going to have to get another job, I think. And I don't know if he got it. She already has to cover a lot of the bills these days, so I'm not going to push her too hard on it. But I would love to get her down there.
Yeah.
And she does get to go on a lot of great trips, but she's been in a little shortage lately.
Yeah, so. Yeah. Well, you'll have to treat her right here one of these days.
I hope so.
Yeah, yeah. Another question, Larry Hall in Michigan. Are those Dorado all residents, or they run seasonably, like steelhead or salmon? That's a good question.
Yep, they run seasonably. I don't know as though they have a, you know, where they all run in the fall. I think it's, like I was saying earlier, when they get rains, these fish run upstream from the big river downstream. And the other reason we just didn't have that many fish around when we were there. The week before, the people had worse fishing than I think had ever been had at the camp. And then the week after us was mediocre at best, and then they got some rain, and I think the fishing from late August all the way into the end of their season in October, I think it was really, really fabulous fishing. In fact, I had some friends there in October that said it was just lights out.
Now, are they running upstream to spawn, do you know? Is it part of
I'm guessing
migration?
That they are. I would think that they are. We didn't see any spawning fish where we were, but, you know, they also had a long ways to go beyond us as well, so they could have definitely been route.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, interesting. Okay, so we're pretty much done with fishing, and you still needed to get back to the lodge and get out of there, right?
Yeah, that day we got back, and, you know, we knew we weren't leaving until 10:30 the next morning. So I remember I didn't pack up my stuff, because I also had intentions of maybe, what the heck, get up at 6 and go for a little hike upstream, make a few more casts, just enjoy the day, maybe try for that Paku one more time. I got up the next morning, and I looked at my wet stuff, which was finally getting a little bit dry, and I was exhausted. And you know, I'd also stayed out late with some of the guides that night, just having reminiscing over our great week. And I didn't go fishing that morning. And I think at 9 o'clock, I really regretted it, because then I kind of had nothing to do. I was packed, and I was like, man, I could have fished a couple hours. But at the same time, I had 6, you know, great days, and you know, I was going to go right back home and get into some fishing at home. So I was at peace with it. But, boy, did I stare at that river from 9 till 10:30 while waiting for that Jeep to get ready to run us back to the boat. And, you know, I watched some fish breaking around a little bit. The only thing that I would have jumped out there for, no matter what, at that time, probably would have been if a Surubi catfish came in sight where I could have sight-casted to them. They have a catfish down there, which is one of the coolest-looking fish on the planet. And I've caught them on bait, but I've never got one to eat a fly, and I want one bad. So, one of these days. But, you know, that morning, none of us fished. We just kind of relaxed and got loaded my last blog and had a nice breakfast. It was great.
And so you were just kind of milling around the, waiting for your ride out, huh? You take a Jeep out or something, or a boat, or what?
Yep, we're basically going to do a reverse of what we did coming in. And I don't know how we're based on here for your next commercial, but I do have a good story here.
Let's just continue on. So let's...
We packed up our stuff. We all had our flight clothes on, because on the way out, you don't have to overnight in Santa Cruz. So we're basically going to take that hour Jeep ride, take the hour boat ride, get on the plane, and land at the Santa Cruz International Airport and get on our flights back to Miami. So we're all dressed, ready to go. You know, the big boys are getting ready to fly in first class. I'm going to be in the back of the bus, but that's fine. Sleeping pill and a glass of wine will be just fine. Well, we got that Jeep ride out of the way. Took us an hour again. Pretty gnarly, rowdy trip, and the boat wasn't there yet. No big deal. Our head guide was with us, and he said, you know, the guy's usually not quite here yet. He waits till he hears the plane, and then he heads up here to get us. So we're standing there up on the riverbank looking down at the Sicure River, the river that I did not get to fish on this lower part here, where some of the best fishing had been. And I'm looking downstream like any fisherman would, and I'm reading the water, and I see the level of the river come up a couple of inches. I'm not kidding you. At first I thought, well, maybe it rained upstream a couple hundred miles upstream. We didn't get any rain, but that can definitely happen. And the water is just getting here, and the river is getting higher because of that. And I stared at it, and I noticed it was actually a bulge moving upstream that was literally 30 or 40 feet long. Something was under the water coming upstream. And I said to Marsilio, one of our, I think he was our head guide, I said, man, does that look like there's a school of fish coming up upstream here? I know you don't see the fish or nothing, but it looks like there's a bulge and possibly even some wakes here and there. And he looked at it, and he said, Jeff, I think you're right. He goes, I think a school of Dorado are coming through. Get your rod out. And I go, well, my rod is completely buried. You know, and it really was. It was like the bottom of my luggage bag. I would have had to find my reel, find a fly. I was thinking about doing it. I was flipping my bag around, and as I was doing that, Dale said, Courier, my rod's right on top, and the reel is still on, and I was going to break it down when we got to Santa Cruz. He pulls it out. I find a fly. Marsilio ties on some wire, and I'm in my flip-flops and my flight clothes, and I just start busting down this hill of jungle, and I get to an outcropped rock. And I'm very close to where I saw that bulge. It took a long cast, like I had to launch an 80-footer out there. I let it swing. I let it sink. I made a few casts. Nothing happened. Then I started prowling around a little bit, and I made a cast into kind of some dead water, and I let it sink too much. Doggone it, I got snagged. And, you know, normally you can strip tight and break your fly off when you're trout fishing or something, but remember, we're using straight 40-pound test. I didn't have another fly on me anyway, and I'm using Dale's equipment. A lot of times when you try to break 40-pound test, you're going to break the fly line, so I didn't want to do that. So I trudged into the jungle to get a different angle at this, walked downstream. I remember sinking up to my thighs in mud. It was like quicksand. Got my flip-flops stuck in there. I had to reach down to the armpits to get my flip-flops back. I was not a happy camper, but I finally got to, you know, downstream where I was snagged, and sure enough, it came undone just fine. I was literally going to cast out to reel in, and I cast it out and decided one more time, I'll make this officially my last cast in Bolivia. And I started stripping, and I got absolutely jolted. And I was downstream of where the guys were, a couple hundred yards. They probably were just talking, not watching. My fish jumps out of the water. I actually probably wasn't paying that very good attention to him. I was looking up to see what the guys were doing. Also, being very distracted because now I hear our boat coming, and I have a fish on. And I know within about 15 seconds that this fish is bigger than any fish I've hooked the entire trip. I can't believe it. The boat is coming upstream. My fish is completely on the other side of the river. He has not jumped again, which is very unusual for Dorado. But I think a lot of us that fish a lot, we know when we get a big fish of a species that normally jumps a lot, it's a really big one, and that's why he's not jumping. The boat that's coming up has nothing to do with our fishing. It's a transport boat. The guy running the boat has no idea about lines and this and that. They are proceeding to run completely over my fly line. Why I have this huge fish on the other side of the river. I'm screaming the best I can. Now, luckily, the guys see me. They're waiting for the boat to come, my guys, and, of course, their guides, and they start shouting down in Spanish to tell this guy to wait until I get this fish on my side of the river. And somehow, at the last second, this all works out. Boat goes up, gets the guys. I am still fighting this fish now. I've been fighting him now for 8 minutes or so, and I've only seen that one jump where I wasn't paying good enough attention. I just know I have a monster. They have time to completely load in the boat and come down. And this is a giant dugout, about a 30-foot dugout canoe that's 6 feet wide that seats about 9-10 people. So now they come down, and I am at this point perched on a rock crop about 8 feet up off the water and kind of in a bad situation because I'm in those darn flip-flops that are covered with slippery mud. And the boat starts coming down, and they're like, what do you want us to do, Courier? I said, get the boat close to me. I'm going to jump off the rock and land in the bow of the boat. And they're like, no way. You are not going to do that. You'll break your neck. I said, there's no time for arguing, guys. I want to land this fish. Get over here now. And they literally came close enough that I could do an evil Knievel type jump, and I didn't know if I was going to die or not. I didn't even look where my feet were going. I just made sure that I kept my rod tight. And I think I jumped, and I was reeling as fast as I could as I was going through the air down to the water, and somehow I managed to crash into the bow of the boat and not break a leg or my rod or anything. And it was funny because the old guys were just, at this point, they had never seen anything like this. They'd seen big fish, they'd seen people catch them, but they'd never seen it done in this last
Courier style.
Yeah, courier style. So I come in splattering mud all over the place and start, you know, dictating what everybody needs to do. I'm telling the boatman, who doesn't understand a word of English, you know, he speaks the Somami Indian language. I'm like, I want to get the other side of the river, because the other side of the river actually had a kind of a muddy beach where I could actually do some fish landing skills there. And as the boatman is finally understanding what I want him to do, he proceeds to start running over my fly line again. And it really wasn't his fault, because the fish had gone upstream and then shot downstream and unfortunately towards the back and under the boat. He figures out the deal again when my line is within about 4 inches of the propeller of the boat. He basically got the boat started to spin and then lifted the motor up, and my line went right under it. At that point, I had had enough. I jumped out of the boat. Luckily, it was chest-deep water, and I kind of did the bob into shore. Long story short, after another 3 or 4 minutes, I beached this fish, and the fish was 27 pounds.
Wow.
It was pretty spectacular luck. I mean, entirely luck.
But yeah.
What a great experience for everybody I was with. We're all together. The entire group is together. Three of the guides, you know, normally you have one guide. They're all together because they're going to take us to get back and pick up the clients for the next week. We're all together for this incredible fish. And, you know, I got in the water and got some great photos and got on that plane soaking wet. And, you know, we've all flown on an airplane a long way where the guy next to you maybe didn't smell so good. Well,
that
the
was
second
you, huh?
time in my life, I got to be that guy.
Yeah.
It was worth it.
Yeah, sounds exciting. Eric in Boise wrote in. He says, love it. This is a true courier story. You must have listened to some of our other shows. Yeah. So.
Yep.
Well, that's an exciting end. You know, I was really beginning to wonder there, Jeff, whether you were going to pull this one off or not. But that, in courier style, you did, you know. So what more can we ask for? Jeez, and what more can you ask for? You got that trophy Dorado, you know. So.
Yep.
Beautiful picture of that fish on your website, too, folks, if you want to go out there. Remember, it's jeffcurrier.com, C-U-R-R-I-E-R, and go check out all the pictures from that trip. It's great. Well, that's a great way to end the show for tonight. What better way to end the show? And congratulations on that, by the way. You worked for that one.
Yep, that's the way it should be, though. Great fish should not come easy.
No, and there's always that little bit of luck, right?
Absolutely.
You know, and that, what do they say, when luck and opportunity come together, then success arrives or something like that? That's what you make of it, too. So, and I know you're a determined fly fisher, so that one more cast may be the one. So we should all keep that in mind as a tip for the future, too. Just one more cast and see what happens. Well, we need to wrap things up, and now's the time to do it. So, Jeff, stick with me here. I'm going to give away a couple of prizes and also your book. And so we'll ask our question of our group tonight, see if we can get a correct answer for that, for a copy of your book, Courier's Quick and Easy Guide to Warm Water Fishing. And people can also get your books and all your artwork and cups and all that stuff off jeffcurrier.com, right?
That's right. I actually have a store now.
Okay, good. Yeah, and if you're not familiar with Jeff's artwork, you've got to go see it. Some beautiful, beautiful fish he's painted and drawn over the years, and need to get a few copies of whatever he's got out there. Do you have a Dorado one yet?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, the lodge down there, Somami Lodge, when their season opens, they open, and I believe in late April, they will have Dorado mugs, and they will be my Dorado. In fact, they'll have Dorado, several products.
Good.
And you can get them on my website, too.
Good, terrific. Okay, well, let's finish things up here. I want to let you know about a mining company up in Alaska. Pac Rim Coal is planning a massive strip mine near Anchorage, Alaska. It's called the Chewitna Coal Project, and it'd be the first project in Alaska history to mine directly through salmon habitat, the Chewitna River drainage, 11 miles of it. Critical commercial, sport, and subsistence fishing economies will be permanently destroyed. Pac Rim says it can rebuild the salmon stream, but scientific experts say they can find no example where successful restoration has occurred after strip mining. Chewitna Coal would be shipped to Asia, leaving Alaska with nothing but devastated habitat and ruined salmon runs. It's time to stop the Chewitna Coal strip mine. And if you want more information about how you can help, visit www.inletkeeper.org. That's inletkeeper.org. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of this show? Just click on that link. Leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Now it's time to give away a few prizes. The winner for our drawings are randomly selected from the show's registration database. And if you didn't register for tonight's show, it's a little late now, but next time, be sure you do it, and you may have a chance to win one of these great prizes. If you are one of the winners tonight, we'll contact you after the show by email and arrange for you to get your prize. Our first thing that we're going to give away is a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. And to learn more about the Federation, go to fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org, a great organization to be part of and to support. So our winner there is Terry Widorp. Don't know if I'm saying that right, Terry, but you know who we are. And he's in Michigan. And you're headed that way, so to speak, for that ice fishing, right, Jeff?
Yeah, and I actually know old Terry. I'm glad he was listening tonight. I've done some steelhead fishing with him and his friends.
Oh,
back
good.
There in Kalamazoo area there. In fact,
oh,
I'll
good.
In October.
Yeah, terrific, terrific. Well, Terry, congratulations. And I know you'll enjoy that membership. If you already have one, we'll get that extended for you, too. So just let us know. We're also giving away a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, courtesy of AmatoBooks.com, AmatoBooks.com. And be sure to go out and check out all the books and publications that they offer. They've got a lot of great fly fishing material out there that I know you'll enjoy. And our winner for that is Phil McCartney in Kentucky. Phil McCartney in Kentucky. Let's write that down. And congratulations, Phil, on that subscription. So I know you'll enjoy it. Well, now, I've got to come up with a question here for tonight's show for you folks out there to win Jeff's book, Courier's Quick and Easy Guide to Warm Water Fly Fishing. And you said you've got a piece in there about Dorado, right, Jeff?
Yes, I do.
Good, good. Let me clear my queue. And all right, so I'm going to make this easy tonight. We'll get Jeff out of here early and so he can recover from his cold here. And so the question is, what's the name of the bait fish that the Dorado loves so much? What's the name of the bait fish? That's an easy one, guys. I'm chucking on it here. Meanwhile, Eric in Boise also wrote in. He says, it's never good enough for the courier. He wants a Paku.
Yes, I do. Luckily, the guys at Untamed Angling know I want my Paku bad, too, and they've invited me back. Hopefully, I can coordinate it in the next couple of years to go fish with those guys.
Yeah.
Got to be good with the owners. That's a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Still checking here. Okay, we got, I think we got a winner. Sabalo, is that correct?
That's correct.
That's correct. Okay, so John McMinn, Newark, Delaware. John, you just won Jeff's book. So what you need to do, John, is I do have your name and email address here. In that same box, send me over your mailing address so that Jeff can send that out to you, and we'll get that sent out to you directly from Jeff's store. So congratulations, John. Thanks for being fast and taking notes, and I know you'll enjoy the book. So thanks again. Well, Jeff, hey, thanks again for being with us. I know it was a little struggle with you working through your voice tonight, but it was clear as a bell on the other end from what they tell me. So thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Thanks, everybody. Good night.
Good night. Our next broadcast will be on February 19th. And 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And in that show, I'm going to be interviewing Kelly Gallup. And our topic for the show will be high stick nymphing. Kelly's a professional guide in Montana, and he'll be talking about high stick nymphing and reading the water. Join us to learn techniques that will fine-tune your nymphing presentations and hook you up with more fish. But we'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Amato Books, Women's Fly Fishing Alaska, Keeney's Fly Shop, and Flats Time Charters for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. That's 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. And we'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website, askaboutflyfishing.com, and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.